negligible quality, talking on a cell phone, saying, "Yeah, yeah, uh-huh," in a tone of voice that suggested there was actually somebody on the other end who cared whether he said uh-huh or nuh-uh. There was a 60-something woman with an Arctic white Gertrude Stein haircut. An old Asian guy was sitting on the floor with no shirt on, all by himself. In front of him on the white pile carpet stood a burned-out brazier surrounded by a ring of ashes. Guess the cleaning lady hadn't come today. Quentin stopped on the threshold. "Julia," Quentin said, "tell me where we are."
"Haven't you guessed yet?"
She practically glittered with pleasure. She was relishing his discomfort.
"This is where I got my education. This is my break bills. It's the anti-break bills."
"These people do magic?"
"They try."
"Please tell me you're joking, Julia." He took her arm, but she shook it off. He took it again and pulled her back down the stairs. "I'm begging you."
"But I'm not joking."
Julia's smile was wide and predatory. The trap had sprung, and the prey was writhing in it.
"These people can't do magic," he said. There's no safeguards. They aren't qualified. Who's even supervising them?" "No one. They supervise each other."
He had to take a deep breath. This was wrong. Not morally wrong, just out of order. The idea that just anybody could mess around with magic, well, for one thing, it was dangerous. That's not how it worked. And who were these people? Magic was his. He and his friends were the magicians. These people were strangers. They were nobody. Who told them they could do magic? As soon as Breakbills found out about this place, they'd shut it down with a goddamn vengeance. They'd send a SWAT team, a flying wedge with fog at the head of it. "Do you actually know these people?" he said. She rolled her eyes.
"These guys?" she snorted. "These guys are just losers."
Julia led the way back into the living room. The only thing the denizens of the safe house had in common, besides their general seediness, was that a lot of them had the same tattoo, a little blue star, seven-pointed, the size of a dime, a heptagram, but solid, colored in. It winked at Quentin from the backs of their hands, or their forearms, or the meaty part between their thumb and forefinger. One of them had two, one on each side of his neck, like Frankenstein's neck bolts. The shirtless Asian guy had four. As Quentin watched, he started in on some involved casting Quentin didn't recognize, staring glazedly through the web of his working hands. Quentin couldn't even look. A red-headed man with freckles, a pint-sized Dennis the Menace type, was sitting up on the gray slate mantelpiece by himself, monitoring the scene, but when he saw them, he boosted himself down and strutted over. He wore an oversized army jacket and carried a beat-up clipboard.
"Hi, folks," he said. "I'm Alex. Welcome to my dojo. You are..."
"I'm Julia. This is Quentin."
"Okay. Sorry about the housekeeping. Tragedy of the commons."
In contrast to everybody else in the room, Alex was chipper and businesslike.
"Check your stars, please."
Julia did the thing again where she showed him the nape of her neck.
"Right."
Alex's ginger eyebrows went up. Whatever he saw impressed him. He turned to Quentin.
"And you?"
"He doesn't have any,"
Julia said.
"I don't have any."
He could speak for himself.
"So did he want to take the test? Because otherwise he can't stay here."
"I understand," Julia said.
The really incredible thing was that she wasn't even mouthing off to this guy. She was being civil. She, a queen of fillery, respected the fucked-up protocol of this place.
"Quentin, he wants you to take a test," she said, "to show you do magic."
"I want lots of things, too. Do I have to do it?"
"Yes, you have to fucking do it," she said evenly. "So do it. It's just the first level. Everybody who comes here does it their first time. You just make a flash. You probably have a fancy name for it."
"Show me."
Julia ran through three well-rehearsed hand positions, lickety-split, snapped her fingers, and said,
Ishik.
The snap produced a little pop of light, like a flashbulb.
Okay.
Hang on, Quentin said. Those hand positions weren't quite generic. Can you... Come on, people, Alex said, not so chipper now. Are we doing this? Quentin saw now that Alex had 8 stars, 4 on the back of each hand. That must make him king of the flophouse.
Come on, Quentin.
Okay, okay. Show me again. She did the spell again. Quentin came at it, trying to crook his fingers the way she did. Breakbills taught you all straight lines, your hands approximating platonic geometry, but these positions were loose and organic. Nothing lined up, and it had been 2 years since he'd worked with real-world circumstances. He tried it once, snap, and got nothing. Then nothing again. This earned him a round of ironic applause. The locals were taking an interest in this transaction.
I'm sorry, one more try and then you're out, Alex said. You can come back in a month.
Julia began to show him again, but Alex put a hand over hers.
Just let him try.
The bouncer, potions master, had come in from the front door and was watching with his arms folded. Quentin could hear other people saying, Ishik. Every time they did, a flashbulb would go off. Screw this. He wasn't going to pick up some corrupt hedge witch spell in 30 seconds that would probably screw up his technique. He was classically trained and a master sorcerer and a king to boot. Let there be light.
Vayomer Elohim, he said. Yehi Or. Vayehi Or.
Let's see who here's got good Aramaic. He closed his eyes and clapped his hands loudly. The light was white and blinding, a flashbulb at close range, right up in your face. For a second, the whole room, shitty carpet, listing torchiere lamps, staring faces, was frozen, all the color driven out of it. Quentin had to blink his vision back to normal, and he'd had his eyes closed. There was a beat of silence.
Holy, someone said.
Then everybody started talking at once. Alex didn't look happy, but he didn't throw them out, either.
Sign in,
he said. He blinked and blotted his eyes on his sleeve. I don't know where you learned that, but just get your flash working next time. Cheers, Quentin said. Alex peeled a blue star sticker off a sheet and stuck it on the back of Quentin's hand. Then he handed Quentin the clipboard. Where it said name, he wrote King Quentin and handed it to Julia. When she was done, Quentin dragged her out through the kitchen with its bumpy linoleum floor and its 15-year-old easy-bake-looking range and its countertops crowded with a multicolored metropolis of unwashed glassware. Enough was enough.
What the hell are we doing here? He hissed.
Come on.
She led him deeper into the house, down a hall that in another saner universe would have accessed Daddy's study and a TV room and a laundry room until she found the cheap hollow-core door that opened on the basement staircase. He closed it behind them. The chilly, mildewed silence of suburban basements everywhere embraced them. The stairs were unfinished pine planks, shaggy with cobwebs. I don't understand this, Julia, he said. You don't belong here any more than I do. You're not like these people. You didn't learn what you know from a bunch of unlicensed losers in a frat house. You can't have. They were alone except for a room full of taped-up cardboard boxes, a dead TV the size of a washing machine, and half a ping-pong table.
Maybe I'm not who you think I am. Maybe I'm an unlicensed loser, too.
That's not what I'm saying.
Was it? He was still trying to get his head around this place.
I can't believe they haven't burned this whole house down by now.
I think what you're trying to say is that you don't think they're good enough. They don't meet your standards.
This isn't about standards, Quentin said, though he felt the ground getting marshy under him. This is about... Look, I paid my dues, that's all I'm saying.
You have to earn this kind of power. You don't just pick it up at the 7-Eleven with your big gulp and your Pokemon trading cards.
And what did I do? You think I didn't pay dues?
I know you paid your dues.
He took a deep breath. Slow down. This place wasn't the problem. The problem was getting back to Fillory.
What did he call this house? A dojo?
Dojo, safe house, same thing. They're safe houses. He's just a dork.
Are there a lot of them?
100, maybe, in this country. There are more on the coasts.
Jesus Christ, it was an epidemic. What was that test back there?
You mean the one you flunked?
That's the test to be a first-level magician. You have to be one to come in here. You pass the test, you get a star tattooed on you, you can stay. Most people get them on their hands, somewhere obvious. The more tests you pass, the more levels you go up, the more stars you get.
But who runs all this? That Alex guy?
He's just a den mother. Takes care of the house. The ranking system is self-policed. Any magician can ask another magician of equal or lower level to demonstrate the test corresponding to their level. Or any of the levels below that, she recited, to prove they know their shit. If you don't know your shit, you get busted down pretty fast.
Huh.
He wanted to find fault with the idea, but couldn't quite do it on the spur of the moment. He filed it away for later discrediting. So what level are you? By way of an answer, she turned around and showed him what she'd shown the doorman and Alex. There was a blue 7-pointed star tattooed on the nape of her neck. Its upper points disappeared into the roots of her hair. She must have had to shave to get it done. It was like the ones he'd seen upstairs, except bigger. A silver dollar. And it had a circle in the middle. Inside the circle was a number 50.
Wow. He couldn't help but be impressed.
Gingerballs back there only had 8. So you're a 50th level magician?
No.
She took hold of the hem of her blouse, crossing her arms in front of her.
Wait a minute.
Relax, playa. She yanked the back of her shirt up, but only halfway. It was covered in blue stars, dozens of them in neat, straight rows. He counted 10 across. There must have been at least 100. She dropped her blouse and turned back to him.
What level am I? I'm the best there is. That's what level I am. And fuck you for asking. Come on. I'm getting us back to Fillory.
She knocked on a heavy, fireproofed door, the kind that in most basements leads to a furnace room. It slid sideways on rollers. The man sliding it sideways looked like a by-the-numbers prepster, with short, blonde hair and a salmon-colored polo shirt, except that he was only about 4 feet tall. Dry, prickly heat billowed from the room.
"What can I do for you this fine evening?"
he said. His teeth were bright and even.
"We need to go to Richmond."
The small man wasn't completely solid, either. He was translucent around the edges. Quentin didn't notice at first, until he realized that his eyes were tracking things behind the man's fingers that he shouldn't have been able to see. They were well and truly through the looking glass now.
"Full fare tonight, I'm afraid. It's the weather. Stresses the lines."
He had the twinkly mannerisms of an old-timey train conductor. He gestured for her to come inside.
"Only the lady, please," said the translucent prepster. "Not the gentleman."
Deference to Julia's secret extra break bills magic scene notwithstanding, enough was enough. Quentin's grasp of real-world circumstances was rusty, but not that rusty. He whispered a quick, clipped series of Chinese syllables, and an invisible hand gripped the man by the back of the neck and yanked him back against the cinder-block wall behind him so that his head bonked against it. If Julia was surprised, she didn't show it. The man just shrugged and rubbed the back of his head with one hand.
"I'll get the book," he managed. "You have credit?"
It was a furnace room, hot and made of unplastered cinder blocks. There was an actual furnace in it, with a fire bucket full of sand next to it,
but there were also two old-looking, full-length mirrors leaning against one wall. They looked like pier glasses that had been salvaged from an old house, fogged in places, with wooden frames. Julia had credit. The book was a leather-bound volume in which she wrote something, stopping in the middle to do mental arithmetic.
When she was finished, the man looked it over and handed them each a string of paper tickets, the kind you'd get if you won at skee-ball at a carnival. Quentin counted his. 9.
Julia took hers and stepped into the mirror. She disappeared like she'd been swallowed by a bathtub full of mercury.
He thought she would. Mirrors were easy to enchant, being somewhat unearthly by nature anyway. Now that he looked at them more closely, he saw the telltale sign. They were true mirrors that didn't invert right and left. Even though he'd just seen Julia walk right through it, he couldn't help closing his eyes and bracing himself to bang his forehead against it. Instead, he passed through with an icy sensation.
Crude, he thought. A cleanly cast portal shouldn't make you feel anything.
What followed had the feeling of a movie montage, a series of shabby, nondescript back rooms and basements, with an attendant in each one to take one of their tickets, and another portal to step through. They were traveling on a makeshift, magical public transit system, basement to basement. These amateurs must have ginned it up piecemeal. Quentin prayed that somebody out there was doing quality assurance on something other than a strictly voluntary basis, so they wouldn't end up materializing 2 miles in the air or directly into the mesosphere 2 miles underground. That would be a real tragedy of the fucking commons. In some cases, whoever set the portal up had had a sense of humor. One was in a TARDIS-style English phone booth. One portal had a mural on the wall around it, a giant circus fat lady bending over and lifting up her dress so that you had to step right into her ass. One stop was completely unlike the others, a hushed executive suite somewhere high up in a skyscraper in some unidentifiable nighttime metropolis. From this height at this hour, it could have been anywhere, Chicago or Tokyo or Dubai. Through a smoky pane of glass, possibly one way, Quentin and Julia could see a room full of men in suits deliberating around a table. There was no attendant here. You were on the honor system. You dropped your ticket into a little bronze idol with an open mouth, and you hit the mirror.
"There are rooms like this all over the world," Julia said as they walked. "People set them up, keep them running. Mostly they're fine. Sometimes you get a bad one."
Jesus. They'd done all this, and nobody at Breakbills had a clue about it. Julia was right. They wouldn't have believed it was possible.
Who was that see-through prepster guy?
Some kind of fairy, lower fairy. They're not allowed upstairs.
Where are we going?
We're going my way.
Sorry, that's not good enough. He stopped walking. Where, specifically, are we going, and what are we doing there?
We're going to Richmond, Virginia, to talk to somebody. Good enough?
It was, but only because the bar for good enough had gotten very, very low. One portal was unexpectedly dead, the room empty and dark, the mirror smashed. They backtracked and haggled with an attendant who rerouted them around the dead node. They gave the last of their tickets to a meek, pretty young flower child with dishwater hair, center-parted. Julia marked the woman's ledger.
"Welcome to Virginia," she said.
They'd slipped in time, as well as space, somehow. When they came upstairs, the first thing they saw was morning sunlight in the windows. They were in a big house, nicely appointed and immaculately kept, with a Victorian feel. Lots of dark wood and oriental carpets and comfortable silence. They definitely traded up from the Winston house. Julia seemed to know the layout. He followed her as she prowled through empty rooms as far as the doorway of a generous living room, which revealed another phase of what Quentin had mentally tagged as the underground magic scene. An older man in jeans and a tie was holding court from an overstuffed couch to 3 teenagers, undergraduate-type girls in yoga pants, who watched him with expressions of awe and adoration.
My God, he thought, these people were absolutely everywhere.
Magic had gotten out. The antimatter containment field had collapsed. Maybe there had never been one.
The man was demonstrating a spell for his audience, simple, cold magic. He had a glass of water in front of him, and he was working on freezing it. Quentin recognized the spell from his first year at Breakbills. Having completed it in what Quentin thought was a basically correct but overly showy style, the man cupped his hands around the glass. When he took them away, it had a skim of ice on it. He'd managed not to break the glass, which the expanding ice often did.
"Now you try it," he said.
The girls had their own glasses of water. They repeated the words in unison and tried to imitate his hand positions. Predictably, nothing happened. They had no idea what they were doing. Their soft pink fingers were nowhere near where they needed to be. They hadn't even cut their nails. When the man noticed Julia standing in the doorway, his face went to shock and horror for about a half second before he was able to bring up a facsimile of delighted surprise. He might have been 40, with carefully mussed brown hair and a fringe of beard. He looked like a large, handsome bug.
"Julia," he called, "what an amazing surprise! I can't believe you're here."
"I need to talk to you, Warren."
"Of course."
Warren was working hard to seem like the master of the situation for the benefit of the room, but it was clear that Julia was very low on his list of people he wanted surprise visits from.
"Hang tight for a minute," he told his acolytes. "I'll be right back."
When his back was to the undergrads, Warren dropped the smile. They crossed the hall into a den. He had an odd rolling gait, as if he were managing a club foot.
"What's this all about, Julia? I've got a class," he said.
"Warren," he added to Quentin with a wary smile. They shook hands.
"I need to talk to you."
Julia's tone was stretched thin.
"All right."
And before she could answer, he said under his breath,
"Not here, in my office, for God's sake."
He ushered Julia toward a door across the hall.
"I'll just wait in the hall," Quentin said. "Call me if..." Julia closed the door behind them. He supposed it was fair play, considering that he'd parked Julia in the hall outside Fogg's office.
This must be as weird for her as going back to Breakbills had been for him. He couldn't make out what they were saying, not without putting his ear to the door, which would have attracted even more attention from the girls in the living room, who were peering at him curiously, probably because he was still dressed in the raiment of a Philorian king.
"Hi,"
he said. They all found something else to peer at.
Raised voices, but still indistinct. Warren was placating her, playing the reasonable one, but eventually Julia got under his skin, and he got loud, too.
"Everything I taught you, everything I gave you,
everything you gave me,"
Julia shouted back. "What I gave you," Quentin cleared his throat.
"Mommy and Daddy are fighting."
The whole scene was starting to seem funny to him, a clear sign that he was becoming dangerously detached from reality. The door opened and Warren appeared. His face was flushed. Julia's was pale.
"I'd like you to leave," he said. "I gave you what you wanted. Now I want you out of here."
"You gave me what you had," she spat back, "not what I wanted."
He opened his eyes wide and spread out his arms.
"What do you want me to do?"
"Just set the gate," she said.
"I can't afford it," he said through his teeth. "God, you are pathetic."
Julia walked stiff-legged back through the house, back the way they came, with Warren trailing after. Quentin caught up with them in the mirror room. Julia was scribbling furiously in the ledger. Warren was busy with his own issues. Something odd was happening to him. A long twig was poking through his shirt at the elbow. It seemed to be attached to him. It was like a dream that just went on and on. Quentin ignored it. They seemed to be leaving anyway.
"You see what you do to me?"
Warren said.
He was trying to twist and snap off the twig, but it was green and bendy, and there seemed to be another branch sticking out from his ribs under his shirt.
"Just by being here, you see what you do?"
He finally wrenched it off and waved it at her, accusingly in his fist.
"Hey," Quentin said. He stepped in front of Julia. "Take it easy."
They were the first words Quentin had addressed to him. Julia finished writing and stared at the mirror.
"I can't wait to get out of here," she said, not looking at Warren.
The meek dishwater woman looked horrified by all this.
Another of Warren's acolytes, without a doubt, she had faded even farther into her corner.
"Come on, Quentin."
He got the freezing shock again, and this time when they stepped through, the transition wasn't instantaneous. They were somewhere else, somewhere dim and in between. Beneath their feet was masonry, old stone blocks. It was a narrow bridge with no guardrails. Behind them was the bright oblong of the mirror they'd come through. Ahead of them, 20 feet away, was another one. Beneath them, and on either side, was only darkness.
"Sometimes they pull apart like this," Julia said. "Whatever you do, don't lose your balance."
"What's down there, under the bridge?"
"Trolls."
It was hard to tell if she was joking.
The room they emerged into was dark, a storeroom full of boxes. There was barely room for them to push their way out of the mirror. The air smelled good, like coffee beans. No one was there to meet them. The coffee smell explained itself when he found a door and opened it onto a cramped restaurant kitchen. A cook barked at them in Italian to move along. They squeezed past him, trying not to burn themselves on anything, and out into the dining room of a café. Threading their way out through the tables, they emerged onto a wide stone square. A beautiful square, defined by some sleepy stone buildings of indeterminate age.
"If I didn't know better, I'd think we were in Fillory," Quentin said.
"Or the Netherlands."
"We're in Italy. Venice."
"I want some of that coffee.
Why are we in Venice?"
"Coffee first."
Bright sunlight on paving stones, clumps of tourists standing around taking pictures and studying guidebooks, looking both overwhelmed and bored by it all at the same time. Two churches fronted the square. The other buildings were a weird Venetian jumble of old stone and old wood and irregular windows. Quentin and Julia walked over to the other café on the square, the one out of whose kitchen they had not just magically burst. It was an oasis of bright yellow umbrellas. Quentin felt like he was floating. He'd never been through so many portals in one day, and it was disorienting. They'd already ordered before they realized they had no euros.
"Fuck it," Quentin said.
"I woke up in Fillory this morning, or maybe it was yesterday morning. Either way, I need a macchiato."
"Why are we in Venice?"
"Warren gave me an address. Someone who might be able to help us. A fixer, kind of. He can get things. Maybe he can get us a button."
"So that's the plan."
"Good. I like it."
He was up for whatever as long as coffee was involved.
"Great. After that we can try your amazing plan, which you don't have."
They sipped their coffee in silence.
Dreamily, Quentin studied the chaotic surface of his macchiato. They hadn't drawn a milky leaf on it the way they would have in America. Pigeons strutted in between the café tables, picking up unspeakably soiled crumbs, their clawed toes looking livid and pink this close-up. Sunlight washed over it all. The light in Venice was like the light in Fillory, stone light. The world had changed again. It wasn't as neatly divided as he remembered it, between the magical and the non-magical. There was this grubby, anarchical in-between now. He didn't much care for it. It was chaotic and unglamorous, and he didn't know the rules. Probably Julia didn't like it either, he reflected, but she hadn't gotten to choose, not the way he did. Well, his world hadn't done them any good. They would go rooting around in hers for a while.
"So who was that Warren guy?" Quentin said. "Seems like you guys have some history."
Warren is nobody. He knows a little magic, so he hangs around the college and tries to impress undergraduates and teach them some things so he can bang them.
Really?
Really.
What happened to him at the end there, with his arm? What was that?
Warren isn't human. He's something else. Wood spirit of some kind. He just has a thing for humans. When he gets upset, he can't keep up the disguise.
So, did Warren bang you? He said.
Who knew where it came from? It just bubbled up out of nowhere, a flash of jealousy, sour and hot, like acid reflux. He didn't see it coming.
He'd had a lot to absorb in one day, or night, whatever it had just been, and it was just a little too much, too fast. It spilled over. Julia leaned across the table and slapped Quentin. She only did it once, but she did it hard.
You have no idea what I had to do to get what was handed to you on a plate, she hissed. And yeah, I banged Warren. I did a lot worse things, too.
You could almost see the waves of anger coming off her, like fumes off gasoline. Quentin touched his cheek where she'd hit him.
I'm sorry, he said. Not sorry enough.
A few people looked over, but just a few. It was Italy, after all. People probably hit each other all the time. Chapter 12. It was another year and a half before Julia saw Quentin again. He'd become a hard boy to find. He didn't seem to have a cell phone, or even a phone, or even an email address. His parents talked in vaguenesses. She wasn't convinced that even they knew how to find him. But she knew how to find them, and he had to come back home once in a while, like a dog to its vomit. Quentin wasn't close to his parents, but he wasn't the type to cut them off all the way. Frankly, he wouldn't have the stones for it.
Julia, though, Julia had the stones for it.
She was a flight risk, no strong ties to the community. When she heard that the Coldwaters had sold up and moved to Massachusetts, she pulled up stakes and followed them.
Even a suburban cultural sump like Chesterton had internet connections and temp agencies. No, especially a suburban cultural sump like Chesterton, and that was all she needed to get by.
She rented a room over a garage from a retired guy with a janitor mustache who probably had a webcam hidden in the bathroom. She bought a beat-up Honda Civic with a wired-shut trunk.
She didn't hate Quentin. That wasn't it. Quentin was fine. He was just in the way.
He had gotten it so easy, and she had it so hard. And why? There was no good reason.
He passed a test, and she failed it. That was a judgment on the test, not on her. But now her life was a waking nightmare, and he had everything he ever wanted. He was living a fantasy. Her fantasy. She wanted it back. Or not even that. She wasn't trying to take anything away from him. She just needed him to confirm that Brake Bills was real, and to open a chink in the wall of the secret garden, just wide enough for her to squeeze through. He was her man on the inside, though he didn't know it yet. So here's how it worked. Every morning before work, she drove past the Coldwaters' house. Every night around 9 o'clock, she drove by again and got out and quietly walked the perimeter of the lawn, looking for traces of her quarry. A McMansion like that, all double-glazed picture windows, broadcast the goings-on inside it out into the night like a drive-in movie. It was summer again, and the summer nights smelled like murdered grass and sounded like crickets fucking. At first, all she learned was that Mrs. Coldwater was a predictable but technically sound amateur painter in a sadly dated pop art mode, and that Mr. Coldwater had a weakness for porn and crying jags. It wasn't till September that the beast showed himself. Quentin had changed. He'd always been lanky, but now he looked like a skeleton. His cheeks were sunken, his cheekbones jagged. His clothes hung on him, his hair, cut your fucking hair already, you're not Alan Rickman, was lank. He looked like shit. Poor baby. Actually, what he looked like was Julia.
She didn't approach him right away. She had to psych herself up for it. Now that she had him where she wanted him, she was suddenly afraid to touch him. She quit taking temp assignments and went full-time on Quentin, but she stayed under the radar. Around 11 every morning, she watched him slam out of the house in a brown study and whiz into town on a hilariously antique white 10-speed. She followed him at a distance. Good thing he was completely oblivious and self-obsessed, or he would have noticed a red Honda with a death rattle shadowing his every move. There he was, the living, breathing, forensic trace of everything she'd ever wanted. If he couldn't help her, or wouldn't, it would be over. She'd have given 2 years of her life for nothing. The fear of finding out paralyzed her, but every day she waited, the risk that he would vanish again grew and grew. She would be back to square zero. All Julia could think of was that if it came right down to it, she would sleep with him. She knew how he felt about her. He would do anything to sleep with her. It was the nuclear option, but it would work. No risk. It was her ace in the hole, so to speak. Who knows? It might not even be so bad. Different, doubtless, from James's smartly paced gymnastic exhibitions. She didn't know anymore why she was so determined not to like Quentin. Maybe he'd been right. Maybe he was the one for her after all. It was hard to know anymore. It was tangled up with everything else, and she was out of practice at having feelings for other people. At this point, it had been a long time since anybody had even touched her. Not since the zookeeper in the bathroom at the party, and that was mostly just spastic, overclothes pawing, entirely clinical in its intent. The patient struggling under the knife while she performed the operation. She felt out of touch with her body, with pleasure of any kind. Dr. Julia noted, purely for the record, that it was scary how unloving she'd become, and how unlovable. She'd locked all that stuff away and melted down the key for scrap. It was in a cemetery behind a church, whither Quentin had retired for more sulking, that she sprang the trap. Looking back on it, she was proud of herself. She could have lost it, but she didn't. She got it out. She said her piece and hung on to her pride and showed him that she was every bit as good as he was. She made the case. She even showed him the spell, the one with the rainbow trails, which she'd gotten down pat over the previous 6 months. Even those murderous hand positions, even the one with the thumbs, she had hit with icy precision. She'd never shown it to anybody before, and it felt great to finally unveil it for an audience. She took that beach like a goddamn marine. And when it came to the nuclear option, when the red phone rung in the war room, Julia hadn't flinched. Oh, no. She took that call. If that's what it took, she would go there, sister. But here was the thing. He wouldn't. She hadn't counted on that. She'd offered as plainly as she knew how. She'd run herself through with the hook and dangled herself before him, pink and wriggling, but he hadn't taken the bait. Julia knew she'd let herself go a bit, looks-wise, but still, come on. It didn't add up. The problem wasn't her, it was him. Something or someone had gotten to him. He wasn't the Quentin she remembered. Funny. She'd almost forgotten people could change. Time had stopped for her the day she'd gotten her social studies paper back from Mr. Karras, but outside the dark, musty interior of her room, time had gone on hurtling forward, and in that time Quentin Makepeace Coldwater had managed to get a boner for somebody else besides Julia. Well, good for him. When he left, she lay down on the cold, soft, wet grass of the graveyard. It rained on her, and she let it. It wasn't that she was wrong. She'd been right. He'd confirmed everything that she'd ever suspected about break bills and magic and everything else. It was all real, and it was extraordinary. It was everything she wanted it to be. Her theoretical work had been admirably rigorous, and she had been rewarded with full experimental validation.
It was just that there was nothing he could do for her. It was all real. It wasn't a dream or a psychotic hallucination, but they weren't going to let her have it. There was a place out there that was so perfect and magical that it had made even Quentin happy. There wasn't just magic there, there was love, too. Quentin was in love. But Julia wasn't. She was out in the cold. Hogwarts was fully subscribed, and her eligibility had lapsed. Hagrid's motorcycle would never rumble outside her front door. No creamy enveloped letters would ever come flooding down her chimney. She lay there thinking on the rich, wet graveyard grass before the tomb of some random parishioner, beloved son, husband, father. And what she thought was this. She'd been right about almost everything. She'd gotten nearly full marks. A minus again. Blew only one question. Here's the one thing I got wrong, she thought. I thought that they could never wear me down. Chapter 13. Shoplifting a city map from a tourist trap wasn't a particularly spiritually enlarging activity. Where was Benedict when you needed him? And the magic involved was trivial. But it gave Quentin enough time to pull himself together. He wished he hadn't said that about Warren. He wished he weren't so tired and so stupid. He wished he could either fall back in love with Julia or get over her all the way. Maybe he was stuck in between forever, like the space between the portals, food for the trolls. Quentin took a deep breath. He was surprised at himself. He knew that he was being weird and kind of a dick. So what if she'd slept with Warren and whoever and whatever else? She didn't owe him anything. God knows he was in no position to judge her. It was partly his fault that she had to do what she did. He could have used someone stable to hang on to right now. But as it happened, through no particular fault of her own, Julia was not a person one could hang on to. She needed one of those warning decals they put on airplane parts. No step. He would have to be that person, the stable, reliable person, the one who had his shit together for both of them. They could either do this together or separately, except they had to do this together. Because he was out of Leeds, and she was very nearly out of her mind. It wasn't a particularly glamorous role. It wasn't the Bingle role, but it was his role. It was time he accepted it. Though so far she'd been a lot more help than he had. When he got back to the table at the cafe, she had undergone yet another unexpected transformation. She was smiling. "You look happy," he sat down. "Maybe you should slap me more often." "Maybe I should," she said. She sipped her coffee. "This is good." "The coffee." "I had forgotten how good it can be." She turned her pale face into the light and closed her eyes like a cat sunning herself. "Did you ever miss it, being here?"
"I honestly never did."
"Me neither. Not until now."
"I had forgotten."
Warren had written the address on a blue post-it, which Julia had kept clutched in her fist all the way from Richmond. Now they pored over the city map together, like all the other tourists in the square were doing, until they'd figured out where they were and where they were going. Their destination was in a neighborhood called Dorso Duro on a street a block off the Grand Canal. Not far. A bridge crossing away. Quentin guessed it was probably only around 9 or 10 at night by their internal clocks, but it was mid-afternoon in Venice, and he felt like they'd been up for days. It was hot in the square, but cool up on the bridge in the seaborne jet stream that blew down the Grand Canal, so they stopped there to orient themselves. There were no cars in Venice, or not in this part anyway. The bridge was a wooden footbridge, disappointingly modern. It would be 100 years at least until it started looking like it belonged in Venice. Beneath them, oily black gondolas poled along, spinning off miniature spiral whirlpools after them,
and sturdy vaporetti chugged, and long, thin barges glided, roiling the green water behind them into milky smoothness. Debauched, listing palazzi lined the canal, all tiles and terraces and colonnades. Venice was the only city that looked the same in real life as it did in pictures. It was consoling that something in this world met expectations. The one factoid Quentin remembered about the Grand Canal was that after Byron was done screwing his mistresses, he used to like to swim home along it, carrying a lighted torch in one hand so that boats wouldn't run him over. He wondered what was happening in Fillory. Would they wait around on After Island for them? Hold an investigation? Put the locals to the sword? Or would they go back to Whitespire? The truth was, whatever was going to happen had probably already happened. Weeks could have gone by already, or years. You never knew how the time difference would work. He could feel Fillory floating away from him, into its future, leaving him behind. Hell must have broken loose when they vanished. But life would go on. They'd get back to normal. Right now, Janet and Elliot could be growing old without him. They'd miss him, but they'd live. Quentin, king of Fillory, needed Fillory more than Fillory needed him. In Dorso Duro, the streets were narrow and quiet. It was less like a stage set and more like a real city than the part they'd come from. People actually seemed to live and work here. They weren't just putting on a show for the tourists. As much as Quentin wanted to hurry through it, to get on with getting back to Fillory, even he couldn't ignore how conspicuously beautiful Venice was. People had been living here for, what, 1,000 years? More? God only knew whose crazy idea it was to build a city in the middle of a lagoon, but you couldn't argue with the results. Everything was made of old brick and stone, with carved blocks of even older stone stuck into the walls at random intervals as ornaments. Old windows had been bricked up, and then new windows had been bashed through the brick, affording glimpses of silent, secret courtyards. Every time they thought they'd left the sea behind, they'd stumble on it again, a dark, angular vein of water branching in between the buildings, lined on both sides with bright-colored skiffs. Just being here made Quentin feel better. It was more suitable for a king and a queen than suburban Boston. He didn't know yet whether they were getting any closer to Fillory, but he felt closer. Julia kept her pace brisk and her eyes fixed straight ahead. It should have been a short walk, 10 minutes at most, but the street plan was so chaotic they had to stop at literally every corner to reorient themselves. They took turns snatching the map from each other and getting lost and having it snatched back. Only about 1 building in 5 had a number on it, and the numbers didn't even seem to be in sequential order. It was a city built for wandering, which was all well and good unless you had urgent business at one very particular location. Finally, they stopped at a wooden door, painted brown, that was barely as tall as they were. It was an open question whether they were on the right street, but if nothing else, the door had the right number on a little stone plaque above it. It had a tiny window set in it, which had been painted over. There was no knob. Quentin put his hand on the warm stone wall next to it. He counted a rhythmic sequence under his breath, and a thick fabric of lines, the deep orange of a heating filament, flashed for a minute over the old stone. "The wards on this place are ironclad," he said. "If your fixer doesn't live here, whoever does knows what they're doing." Either they were about to improve their situation or significantly worsen it. There being no buzzer, Quentin knocked. The door didn't resonate under his knuckles. There could have been a solid mile of rock behind it. But the window swung open promptly.
"Si?"
Darkness inside. "We'd like to talk to your boss," Quentin said. The window shut immediately. He looked at Julia and shrugged. What else was he supposed to say? She looked back at him impassively from behind her black glasses. Quentin wanted to walk away. He wanted to go back, but there was no back to go to. The only way out was through, onward and downward. The street was silent. It was narrow, practically an alley, with buildings going up 4 stories on either side.
Nothing happened.
After 5 minutes, Quentin muttered some words in Icelandic and held his palm an inch away from the door. He felt the wall around it, which was in the shade, but still warm.
"Stand back," he said.
Whoever made the wards knew what they were doing, but they didn't know everything Quentin knew. He moved the heat from the wall, all of it, into the little glass window, which expanded as glass will when it's heated. The wards were good enough that the heat didn't want to go, but Quentin had ways of encouraging it. When the glass couldn't expand anymore, it popped with a ping like a light bulb. Warren's students would have been impressed.
"Stronzo," he called through the empty frame. "Facci parlare con tuo direttore del cazzo."
A minute passed. Quentin's thermal transfer spell had made a sheen of frost appear on the old stone wall. The door opened. It was dark inside. "See," he said, "I did learn something in college." A short, heavy-set man met them in the foyer, a tiny room lined with brown ceramic tiles. He was surprisingly gracious. They must have to replace that little window a lot.
"Prego."
He ushered them up a short flight of stairs into one of the most beautiful rooms Quentin had ever seen. He'd been snowed by Venice's bizarre topography. He'd assumed they'd be shown into some crap Eurotrash crash pad, with white walls and uncomfortable couches and tiny geometrical lamps. But the building's exterior was pure camouflage. They were in one of the big palaces on the Grand Canal. They'd come in the back way. The entire front wall was a row of tall windows with Moorish peaks, all looking out onto the water. The obvious intention was to awe guests into a state of trembling submissiveness, and Quentin surrendered immediately. It was like a full-scale mural, a Tintoretto maybe, with vivid green water and boats of all shapes and sizes, imaginable and unimaginable, crossing back and forth. Three hideous, glittering Murano chandeliers lit the room, translucent octopuses dripping with crystals. The walls were stacked with ranks of paintings, classical landscapes and scenes of Venice. The floor was old marble tiles, their lumps and scars smothered under overlapping oriental carpets. Everything in the room was very much just so. It was the kind of room you wanted to spend years in. It wasn't fillery, but things were definitely looking up. It felt like Castle Whitespire. Their escort departed, and for the moment they were left to their own devices. Quentin and Julia sat on a sofa together. Its legs were so deeply carved it looked like it was going to walk away. There were 4 or 5 other people in the room, but it was so huge that it seemed private and empty. 3 men in shirt sleeves were talking in low tones over a tiny table, sipping something clear out of tiny glasses. A broad-shouldered old woman stared out at the water with her back to them. A butler, or whatever they were called in Italy, stood at the foot of the stairs. Everyone ignored them. Julia squished herself into one corner of the couch. She pulled her feet up, putting her shoes on the nice antique upholstery.
"I guess we take a number," Quentin said.
"We have to wait," Julia said. "He will call us."
She took off her glasses and closed her eyes. She was starting to withdraw again. He could see it. It seemed to come in waves. Maybe it was because she felt safe here. She could let herself go for a while. He hoped so. He would take it from here. "I'm going to get you some water."
"Mineral water," she said. "Fizzy. And ask him for rye."
If there was one thing being a king prepared you for, it was talking to domestic staff. The butler had both mineral water, frizzante, and rye. He brought the rye neat, which seemed to be how Julia wanted it. She ignored the water. He worried about her drinking. Quentin liked a drop here and there, God knew, but the volume of alcohol Julia could consume was heroic. He thought of what Elliot told him about what he'd seen at the spa. It was like Julia was trying to anesthetize herself, cauterize a wound, or fill in some part of her that was missing.
Warren's fixer must be pretty good at fixing things, Quentin said. This place is nice even by magician standards.
I cannot stay here, was all Julia said.
She sat there sipping the rye and shivering, cupping it between her hands as if it were a magic healing cordial. She drank without opening her eyes, like a baby. Quentin had the butler bring her a wrap. She had the butler bring her another rye.
I can't even get drunk anymore, she said bitterly.
After that, she didn't speak. Quentin hoped she could rest. He occupied the other end of the couch, sipping a Venetian spritz, Prosecco, Aperol, soda, twist of lemon, olive, and looking out at the canal and not thinking about what they'd do if this didn't work out. The palace directly opposite them was pink. The setting sun was turning its salmon. Its windows were all shuttered. Over the years it had settled unevenly. One half had sunk slightly, while the other half stayed where it was, creating a fault line up the middle. It must have run through the whole building, all the rooms, Quentin thought. People were probably always tripping on it. Stripy poles stuck up at odd angles from the water in front of the pink palace. It was strange to be in a place and not be king of it. He'd gotten out of the habit.
It was like Elaine had said. Nothing made him special here. Nobody noticed him. He had to admit it was strangely relaxing. It was an hour, and Quentin had cut himself off after his third spritz before a small, intense young Italian in a pale suit, no tie, came and invited them upstairs.
It was the kind of outfit an American couldn't have gotten away with in a million years. He showed them into a small, all-white salon with three delicate wooden chairs set around a table. There was a plain silver bowl on the table. No one sat in the third chair. Instead, a voice spoke to them out of the air. A man's voice, but high and whispery, almost androgynous. It was hard to tell where it was coming from.
"Hello, Quentin. Hello, Julia."
That was creepy. He hadn't told anybody their names. "Hi." He didn't know where to look. "Thanks for seeing us."
"You're welcome," the voice said. "Why have you come here?"
"I guess he doesn't know everything. We'd like to ask for your help with something."
"What would you like me to help you with?"
"Showtime." He wondered if the fixer was even human, or some kind of spirit like Warren, or worse. Julia was doing her thousand-yard stare, a million miles away. "Well, we've just come from another world, from Fillory, which, as it turns out, is a real place. You probably knew that." "Ahem, start again. We didn't mean to leave. It was kind of an accident. And we want to go back there."
"I see."
Pause.
"And why would I want to help you with that?"
"Maybe I can help you, too. Maybe we can help each other."
"Oh, I doubt that, Quentin."
The voice dropped an octave. "I doubt that very much." "Okay." Quentin looked behind him. "Right, look, where are you?" He was starting to feel painfully aware of how vulnerable they were. He didn't have much of an exit strategy, and the fixer shouldn't have known their names. Maybe Warren had called ahead. That wasn't a comforting thought.
"I know who you are, Quentin. There are circles in which you are not a very popular man. Some people think you abandoned this world. Your own world."
"All right. I wouldn't say abandoned, but okay."
"And then Fillory abandoned you."
"Poor little rich king. It doesn't seem like anyone wants you, Quentin." "You can look at it like that if you want. If we can just get back to Fillory, everything will be fine. Or at any rate, it's not your problem, is it?"
"I will be the judge of what is and is not my problem."
The back of Quentin's neck prickled. He and the fixer weren't getting off to a roaring start. He
He weighed the advantages of laying on some basic defensive magic. Prudent, but it might spook the fixer into trying a preemptive strike. He shot Julia a glance, but she was barely following.
All right. I'm just here to do business.
Look in the bowl,